House Trade and Economic Committee will come to order. And before we begin our main agenda, I want to thank the Representative Dellum, okay? For inviting us to the House. And we had a real good meeting and good time. And I appreciate you and the U.S. staff organizing for the meeting.
Very well done.
We had a wonderful time and met wonderful people. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I must say that I went right home and had an extra helping of Cherry Garcia ice cream.
Just doing your part.
I got it at the grocery store. Representative Buckley, we did go through the cherry processing plant there.
That
supplies the cherries for the ice cream. So now I know I'm helping out the Oregon economy.
Much appreciated.
At the same time, I'd like to participate at the cherry seed spitting contest. for seniors, not with the young guys.
Okay. It was wonderful.
Yes, and I just want to also thank the Jim and Erin and for organizing and also driving us down there.
Appreciate your committee staff organized the transportation only. It was Representative Dellum and his staff, David Huntington, who organized that whole day for us there. They did a wonderful job, I thought.
I think it was what's incredible is it's an example of what you can do when you know, the county, state, and federal government all work together. And I was fortunate to also get to go to the veterans' home there that is also a partnership between the county and the federal government. And it was just awesome. And I was so proud to see our veterans being treated so well in such a wonderful facility.
Beautiful view.
Also, before we begin main agenda, I want to thank the Representative Peter Buckley for inviting. I'm sure you all are invited, but me and my wife went over to the Ashland to see the play of this is Richard III.
Richard III.
Yep. And what was the other one? Long name.
Did you see the George Bernard Shaw play too? The Philanderer.
The Philanderer. I enjoyed that one. And also, what was the other one of the Bernard? That was a Bernard Shaw, right? And the other one
is room service.
Room service. Yes. So that was a lot of fun. So I wish you to go down there next year. And this is a great play, and this is the only play in the United States such kind. You know, so
the Shakespeare. Yes.
All right. Without further ado, I'd like to good morning, and I'd like to invite at this time Dr. Jeffrey Morata, and you were scheduled to present about 2 weeks ago, but because of time was short, we were not able to do it. But thank you for coming again, and welcome. Please give your name and to begin with.
Chairman Lynn, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Morata. I'm the Problem Gambling Services Manager for the Department of Human Services. I want to thank you for having me here today. I'm very pleased to be able to present to this committee because I recognize that this committee is very concerned about the issue that I'm here to speak to you about. Just to give you a little bit of background, I'm a clinical psychologist in training, been specializing in problem gambling for up to about 10 years now. Prior to coming to Oregon to take the current position that I'm in, I worked as faculty with the Institute for the Study of Gambling and Commercial Gaming. So I'm very much knowledgeable in this field beyond some of the administrative capacities of running a program. I want to start by just providing an overview of the context of gambling services in Oregon. Well, gambling in Oregon, as you're very well aware, is growing. In 2002, there was a study conducted that demonstrated that about over $1 million were being wagered in all forms of gambling. That's 447 per adult, which represents a 25% expenditure above the national average. So back in 2002, we were already gambling as a state more than most jurisdictions in the United States. 2003, legislation made way for a 20% increase in video lottery terminals. Oregon is only one of five states with video lottery terminals. In 2004, a ninth tribal casino opened in Oregon. Now each of our nine federally recognized tribes are operating a casino. And in 2005, the lottery is poised to expand, and is planning to expand into electronic slot gaming, and new tribal casinos are planned to rise closer to Portland. So we have increased access through these activities, and the other thing that's co-occurring is the popularity of gambling. It's at an all-time high. It's portrayed as fun, exciting, glamorous, fashionable, easy route to fast money. Recent surge in television shows around gambling. And the popularity can also be seen by just going into some of the stores. This past Christmas season, you might have noticed that gambling merchandise sales were quite present. And that's really a first as far as I can tell. Just the sheer quantity of gambling merchandise, the popularity of it. Well, greater access and greater acceptance of gambling means more gamblers. And the issue there is the more gamblers, the more problem gamblers. The prevalence of gambling disorders, generally speaking, is a function of the overall level of gambling participation. The more people gamble, the more problem gamblers you're going to have. So what has Oregon done in response to the issue of problem gambling? We've actually been at the forefront of addressing this issue for a number of years. Back in 1991, when legislation authorized video poker, it included a requirement to fund problem gambling treatment. At that time, 3% of the video poker proceeds, lottery proceeds, would go into a fund to treat gambling addiction. There was a problem with that legislation, and that portion of the bill was deemed inappropriate, so that we lost that funding at that time. However, funding came back. We had a relatively an unstable funding situation up until 1991, when legislation was put into place in order to create a stable funding base, and one that made a lot of sense. It indexed the amount of revenues that went into this issue of problem gambling by indexing 1% of lottery proceeds into a gambling treatment fund. It also moved the administrative responsibility of those monies over to the Department of Human Services, with the mandate that those funds would be used in programs that showed accountability and that programs that were based on performance standards. So that was really, I think, hallmark legislation. Then in 2003, this is just to demonstrate how fragile the funding system turned out to be, there was it with House Bill 5077, it eliminated the allocation for gambling addiction treatment. Fortunately, those funds were restored back to $5.6 million, which, as you will notice from the slide, does not represent the 1% minimum that was provided through this 1999 legislation. And currently, we are receiving 0.7% of lottery proceeds that DHS has the authority to spend on problem gambling services. This will just show you this graphic image of the way the system has grown, both in funding and the number of persons treated. What you'll see here, over the past five biennium, there has been an increase in both funding and in the number of persons seen in treatment. However, that trend line is quite different. Over the past five biennia, the level of funding overall has increased about 35% into these programs. However, the amount of individuals treated has increased 130%. And up until this last biennium, we had seen an on average of 40% increase in the number of people seeking treatment for problem gambling. This last meeting, we did not realize those numbers, and in part that was because we lost a lot of infrastructure when we thought the monies were going to go away. As you can imagine, if you're a business operator and you heard that your funding was going to get pulled, you'd start closing your doors, and that's exactly what happened. And unfortunately, we lost some very good providers because they were concerned about how they're going to pay their bills and found employment elsewhere during this time of uncertainty. So we still saw an increase in the number of people being treated, but we didn't hit that 40%. A little bit about Oregon Problem Gambling Services, and it's a program that has been set up to really follow more of a public health approach toward the issue of problem gambling. The reason why I believe personally that the public health approach is one that makes the most sense is because problem gambling is something that doesn't only affect individuals. We know that it has just catastrophic effects on those individuals who do develop a gambling problem, and for some of those individuals whose gambling problem progressed to just dreadful levels. You heard last time when we talked about problem gambling in this room about the way it affects families. And then the other aspect of problem gambling is that it affects communities. It affects communities in a number of ways. Economically, also through the community fabric by workplace productivity, dropping, bankruptcy, crime, medical resources. These are all things that are impacted by problem gambling. Now, because we do view problem gambling as really affecting so many different areas, we set up a system to address problem gambling from a more comprehensive standpoint. We have a problem gambling helpline. We have 25 outpatient treatment centers. That's to make treatment as accessible as possible for individuals. We have two residential crisis respite programs. Those are for the individuals who really need a very intensive level of care. Generally speaking, those individuals are suicidal. Often they don't have a place to stay because they burnt through all their financial resources and their personal resources. As one can imagine, a serious pathological gambling problem can create. So it provides them some housing as well. We have the GEAR program, which is one of Oregon's innovative programs addressing problem gambling. It's where individuals can call a number and enroll in an intervention that allows them to receive a self-help kind of workbook, also receive telephone counseling, and get hooked up to things like online chat groups. It's a program that doesn't have walls, so people anywhere in the state, even in the most rural areas, and this is one of our target populations, would be able to receive some kind of services to help them curb their gambling behavior if they were motivated to do so. We have the GEAR Coffee Creek program. This is a pilot program that we just began last year where we have an intervention in the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility where we screen all the individuals who are about to be released. 6 months prior to the release, they enter a pre-release program. All the inmates do this prior to the release. They're screened for gambling problems. Those who report a history of a gambling problem are then invited to participate in this voluntary program, at which time they receive a four-week course where they are taught the warning signs, things that they really need to be very concerned about going back into society that has such prevalence of gambling, and that they are considered high risk because they have a history of a gambling problem. They are educated about the different resources they have available to them and some strategies on how to avoid problems. Hopefully with additional funding, we hope to expand that program into the other correctional facilities, the state correctional facilities in Oregon. That program, just on the side, found that 25% of the women in Coffee Creek had a history of a gambling problem. It's just a phenomenal number. A fourth of those individuals in prison had a history of a gambling problem. We have 19 regional problem gambling prevention programs. We have extensive quality control and evaluation component, a workforce development program, and also a resource center. Since 1996, we have a few significant trends emerge. One is the proportion of women receiving services.
Excuse me, one question I have.
Yes, sir. Well,
is your main focus is the treatment or prevention or both together?
Chairman Lim, we feel that the combination of treatment and prevention is critical. Our focus has been on treatment. More recently, we have intensified our prevention efforts. Most of the prevention actually falls in the category of outreach. And what I mean by that is we have programs where we screen individuals entering other public systems, alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment, if they're coming for some kind of social assistance, they're screened for a gambling problem. The idea there is if we can catch them earlier before their gambling creates a lot of devastation in their life, we can reduce the harm. We also have some true prevention programs where we're in schools and we're talking to youth about some of the risks associated with gambling. The split, it's about 15% of the funds go into the prevention outreach efforts, the local community ones. Then about 65-70% go into direct treatment services.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, you mentioned warning signs. Could you outline those for us a little bit and tell us what the warning signs are and how you know you're about to become a problem gambler?
Chairman, Representative Riley, I'd be happy to do that. What we find with a number of the individuals who enter our programs...
Is it possible? Can you speak closer to the mic if possible?
Sure. What we're finding is that the people who come into our treatment programs, none of them are seeking out an issue with their gambling behavior. They start very innocently, not recognizing that gambling is even a risky activity for them. They start for fun, entertainment, socially. Then they find that in the case of video poker, which seems to produce the largest number of people into our treatment centers, what they find that with a number of those individuals, they actually find it relaxing, which is in contrary to what a lot of people think about gambling. It's more of an excitement-producing activity. They actually find it relaxing. And from there, some individuals will start to depend on that activity in order to relax to an extreme measure in terms of to cope. And when you even take it further than that, it's coping in a way that it allows them to escape from their problems or almost to disassociate from their issues. They develop a reliance on it. And as they do so, their gambling intensifies, their problems get worse, their need to gamble becomes greater and it starts a vicious circle. So some of those warning signs that show up is one, reliance on the game in order to cope. Another one is thinking about gambling. We call it preoccupation. It's basically during empty time they're thinking about gambling. In fact, even not during empty time, they're distracted by their thoughts that have to do with either gambling or ways to get money to gamble. Individuals will their functional activities will start becoming affected. They won't, their work performance goes down. They spend less time with family. Other kind of signs are chasing. So they start, if they're losing money, they'll start betting more in order to recoup the money they lost. That's another warning sign. Borrowing is certainly a heavy one. If they start having to reach to others or depend on others, including their financial institutions, in order to get money to gamble. So going beyond really what their limits are, that's another warning sign. And then the biggest telltale sign that somebody has a gambling problem is when they actually commit some type of criminal activity related to their gambling. That's using the form of writing a bad check. Or it could be some petty theft.
Thank you.
Okay. Vice Chair Merkley.
Mr. Chairman. Dr. Marotta, you mentioned that 25% of the women at Coffee Creek have a history of gambling. Has there been kind of an examination of how that interconnects to their activities that lead them to being in Coffee Creek? Is there a connection? Is it a certain type of crime associated with a gambling background, et cetera?
Chairman, Representative Merkley. Yeah, one of the things that we asked them in our surveys was, first of all, if we surveyed around their gambling activity to determine if they had a history of a gambling problem. And we also asked them if they believed their gambling, if their gambling led to their incarceration. I don't have those numbers directly in front of me. What I can tell you is that a high portion of those individuals did state that they felt like their gambling contributed to the behavior that led to their incarceration. Frequently among that population, and went hand in hand with chemical or drug issues, and we found this a lot in that population, where people would use meth or get high and then go gamble. And then there would be some reported that they would sell drugs in order to get money to gamble and also to buy additional drugs, but they definitely told us that was, for some of those folks, that was part of their motivation for the criminal activity. So in that population particularly, we see a hand-in-hand, not 100%, but we saw a large number of co-occurring problems there.
Thank you.
Now, again, in your report, it shows that the Oregonians spend about $450 a year, which in average, and 25% more than national average. Why do you think we gamble more than any other state?
Chairman Lin, just looking at some of the national figures on this gives us a better indication of what might be happening in Oregon. What we find there is states that have greater gambling availability, their population tends to gamble more. So the greater availability, greater access to gambling, especially convenience gambling, is what, and that's what we have here in Oregon. We have a larger per capita expenditure toward gaming. So that appears to be the primary reason why, on average, we are gambling more than other states in the country, because primarily it's the video lottery terminals. That's what makes up our convenience gambling.
Thank you.
Just to kind of move forward here. Just a little bit about our clients. This is from our 2003 data. We're about to release our 2004, so you might see some discrepancies in the reports that come out very soon. Small ones, though. The majority of the people who come into our programs are Caucasian, 46%. In 2003, 2004, we had 48% were women. Average age is 44. 41% married, and that the married figure was actually much. If we went back and we asked them if they were married a year ago, that number would be quite a bit higher. The gambling led to divorce in many circumstances. 53% work full time. Average income was about $40,000. Average education 13 years. And the last figure is something that a lot of people find surprising, and that is 71% of the people who come into our state-funded programs report no alcohol or drug problems. One of the misconceptions out there is that individuals who develop gambling problems have this addictive type personality, and therefore it's the person, it's not the environment or the circumstances. But what we're finding is that the majority of people who come in for gambling treatment don't have a current drug and alcohol problem. Many of them don't have any histories of mental health or chemical dependency issues.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dallum.
Yes, we're talking about 87% being Caucasian. What is the number so we can get some notion of what we're dealing with? 87% of what number? How many people come in?
Chairman, Representative Dallum. The number there was 1,500 people that came in 2003 for gambling treatment. We had an additional 300 family members come in for services as well. One of the things the system provides for is treatment not only for those who experience an issue related to their direct gambling behavior, but also for family members or other concerned persons. So that's 87% of, which actually I believe mirrors roughly the Oregon demographics. So it would be several hundred people there. Hopefully that answers your question.
What?
These are some of the consequences that people reported who came into our programs. This is based on, again, on that sample of 1,500 people seeking treatment last year, or in 2003. 34% committed illegal acts to gamble. 27% lost a marriage or other significant relationship due to gambling. 23% reported suicidal thoughts. 14% reported job irresponsibility. And there's a big gamut there in terms of the severity. The other interesting thing here is the debt ratio. What we found, and this is the first time we ran the statistic, is that people generally had a 1-to-1 ratio of gambling-related debt to their annual household income. What that means is if somebody was making $500,000 a year, when they were coming into our programs, they were $500,000 in debt. If somebody was making $15,000 a year, when they were coming into our programs, they were $15,000 in debt. On average. But it was amazing. That it was exactly 1-to-1. I mean, that's it was somewhat of a surprising finding.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, Dr. Murata. How are individuals referred to these people? Do the police do it? The sheriff?
Chairman, Representative Nelson, the way that the majority of people come into our programs, or a large proportion of them, is through the helpline. Most of that, either a family member directs them to it or they look it up themselves. We have brochures at all the lottery retail location. The retailers are required to post signage that provides that Oregon Problem Gambling Helpline number. So people are basically calling the helpline as the central access point. We get very few mandatory referrals, and that's one of the big differences between our problem gambling treatment system and our drug and alcohol treatment system. Yeah, we have a very, very small number. Less than 10% of the people that come in are mandated to come in for treatment.
Let me go back to the questions I had earlier. That the 25% more gambling in our state, are they including all Indian tribes, 9 tribes together, plus the video poker games, all inclusive?
Yeah, Chairman Lim, that's correct. That study is by Colonel Northwest in 2002, and what they did is they looked at total gaming expenditures in Oregon. So they did look at the tribes as well.
Could you show us, and since the inception, especially the video poker games, that I'd like to see the number each year. It's continued to grow, tendency to grow. It doesn't show any numbers in here in the last maybe 15 years or so, since 1991.
Is that in reference to the number of problem gamblers?
The problem gamblers seeking the treatment.
Seeking treatment, okay. The number of problem gamblers seeking treatment has steadily increased. In fact, this last year was the very first year we didn't have a higher number than the previous year coming into treatment. The caveat there is it's not real clear why our numbers are increasing. We think in large part they're increasing because we're doing a better job letting the public know that these services are available. The services are also building a stronger reputation as being very good services, services that the public can trust. So it's not clear if that's because we have more problem gamblers in our society or in Oregon, or if it's because our programs are just being more recognized and utilized. We do have two prevalence studies that were conducted in Oregon, and that's really the best indication of the extent of the problem. In 1997, that was our first prevalence study. What was found was that 3.3% of the Oregon population had met the criteria for probable pathological gambling or problem gambling.
Pardon me, 1994, that the e-board recovered the treatment money, April.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened before that? Did you discontinue the treatment, how that happened? Because of that reason, maybe number didn't add up.
Chairman Lim, what happened? So this is in reference to last year when the funding was in jeopardy. What happened was we had received an appropriation of $5.6 million. However, as you recall, there was a bill passed at the end of session that was going to affect if the tax surcharge referendum was to be overturned, and it was overturned, and that second budget package went into effect, and in that second budget package, the funding for gambling treatment was eliminated. It was scheduled to be eliminated in May. The April e-board came and restored that funding, so we never actually lost the appropriation. We never had the funding stop. However, many believe that it was going to stop. It was scheduled to stop, and that's when a lot of the disruption actually occurred.
Good. Thank you. Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand you to say that 3.3% of Oregonians were problem gamblers?
Representative Merkley, yes. And from the 1997 prevalence study, 3.3%.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So that would be well over 100,000 people, if my math is on target. And we're only getting 1,500 people seeking treatment. What's happening to the other 99,000?
Representative Murphy, that's a very good question. Just as a little, I want to back up just a second here. And there has been a more recent prevalence study done in 2000, and that one showed our prevalence going down to 2.3%. There's still a very large discrepancy, so we're talking about 80,000 people, adults, that we believe have a gambling problem. Out of 80,000, we're seeing 1,500. I think that's about, 2% or something like that. Now, that is a very small number. However, when we look across the United States and large studies that look at gambling prevalence, they also ask about whether or not these individuals ever went into treatment. We find it's less than 1%, generally speaking, ever show up for treatment. This is one of the characteristic issues or defining problems of this field, is getting problem gamblers into treatment. So we're doing much better than other places in the country, 2 to 3 times better. However, we have a long way to go. That is one of our goals, is to bring in more people. In fact, one of the things I'd like to share with you at the conclusion of my portion is ask Carol Bono from the Oregon Lottery to come up and talk to you more about some of our efforts to bring a larger number of problem gamblers into our services. And what's happening with them? Sorry. That's a very good question, and unfortunately we just don't really know. There's lots of speculation. I mean, we went into our prison system and found that 25% of the prisoners in there had a gambling problem. That certainly doesn't account for all of them, though. Some people tell you a large number are either leaving Oregon because they want to go somewhere where there's fewer gambling opportunities, someplace that's safer for them. However, that's harder and harder to find these days. Others, people will tell you that's because they're, you often hear because they're committing suicide or they're in prison. However, I think the biggest proportion of those individuals that aren't coming in for treatment out of those 80,000 are actually overcoming their problem, at least for a time being on their own, or through some means that we're just not tracking, through their church, through private pay help, through other forms of change.
Okay. Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Murad, is there any way to quantify what the costs are to the state of Oregon with these 80 to 100,000 folks that are not being treated? I guess my question is, I realize it's not an easy question, but simply we can measure what the benefits to the state of Oregon are for public gambling, for mm-hmm. Oregon Lottery. Mm-hmm. To make a reasoned decision about the course of gambling in the future, we need to understand the true costs. And I mean, you even point out that 25% of the prison system is made up of a problem gambler. So that's an easy cost to quantify. But can we go past that? Can we get our handle, or can we get our arms around the bigger picture with any sense of accuracy?
That is a very good question. It's one that the field has been struggling with for a number of years now. Really, considered just looking at it more in depth over the past 5 or 6 years, I think. It's very difficult to accurately quantify the costs of problem gambling. One reason is we just don't collect the type of information we need. For instance, when there is a suicide in this state, the coroner doesn't have a place to check whether or not that person was a problem gambler, that suicide was in any way connected to their gambling. A lot of the crimes that might be related to gambling, again, we just don't keep the kind of statistics in order to know whether or not the crime was related to a person's gambling or not. The descriptive nature of the crime is what's recorded. So it's a very difficult thing to really wrap our arms around with any kind of accuracy and have hard numbers. Given saying that, people have tried, and there's numbers out there. The number that is being reported most commonly these days is from former economic advisor of the Reagan administration, so somebody who has some legitimacy. And what he found, and this was, he mainly looked at the cost of casino gamblers. What he found was that each pathological gambler contributed around $11,000 in social costs, and each problem gambler, which has milder variant of a gambling problem, contributed about $3,000 in social costs. Now, what some economists will argue about is with looking at the cost-benefit analysis, any kind of cost, you have to deduct the benefits out of it. And how do you quantify the enjoyment that gambling brings so many people? And that would have to go into the equation according to some of these economists. The other thing, like this, the most recent proposal by Governor Kolombowski to fund state troopers with the revenue brought in by slots, is that could save a lot of money in social costs as well, if it's going to prevent things like the number of accidents on Oregon highways. So it really is a very difficult thing to accurately quantify. What's clear is that there are some significant social costs. I think it's also clear there's some significant economic gains. What's not clear is really how those things weigh out.
Thank you.
Representative Dallow?
Yes, if you identify a person with a gambling problem, Is there some actual figures or on what it takes to what kind of costs are involved to remedy that problem?
Chairman and Representative Dallin, we know on average what it costs a client to go through our system, our publicly funded system. And somewhere, I'd have to look up to for the exact number, but I think it's around $1,100 or so. And that doesn't include the money that goes for prevention and outreach. That's just strictly the money that goes into treating that particular individual. So that's correct. So it's very efficient. When we look at the amount of money that kind of goes into the treatment, it's very efficient. The problem is getting these people into the treatment. That's where we're really struggling. It's not so much on, I think, an overinflated cost to fix, or I shouldn't say fix, to assist an individual with their recovery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. are there any studies which show how effective this treatment is? Are there any, you know, follow-ups a year or 2 years later, anything like that?
Thank you, Chairman Lynn, Representative O'Reilly. I'm glad you asked that question. Thank you. I feel like you're my plant in the committee here. We do conduct follow-ups. We had an extensive effort to collect follow-up information. We curtailed that. We used to try to follow every single individual that ever stepped into the door of one of our publicly funded treatment systems. And we surveyed them at 90 days, 6 months, and then 1 year. And the reason why we felt like that was very important is because most of our clients actually weren't completing their full recommended course of treatment. We didn't know what that meant. We didn't know if they were leaving because they got what they needed, and they left, or they were going out and they were gambling. We just didn't know what was happening to them. And what we found is what this slide will show you is really, from that survey, from that follow-up data, that 80% of our clients report either no gambling or much less gambling 6 months after they left treatment. That's that includes both people who left after they completed their full course of treatment and individuals who might have only stayed around for the first, you know, 5 or 6 sessions, then decided that they got what they needed. For individuals who stayed and successfully completed treatment, that number is actually much higher. There it's in the 90s, I believe something like 95%. It's very, very high. But again, we're only following this at 6 months. We follow them again at 1 year. But, you know, whether or not those effects are going to hold after 5 years remains a question to be answered.
So the 1 year numbers are similar, or
The 1 year numbers, it does drop. There is attrition there. So the long at each data point, you know, again, 180 days, 6 months, mm-hmm. 1 year, and for some of the population, again, when we had larger resources, we were following them for 2 years. Every time we went back to check on them, there were fewer that were reporting no gambling or much less gambling. However, it was a pretty small number. So the results were holding in large part. I think it dipped down to like 75 or 70% or something like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Concerning the gambling issue, is it possible for you to identify that the gambling problem comes from mostly from the state-sponsored gambling, such as a video poker, mm-hmm. or what percentage is coming from the Indian tribes?
Mm-hmm.
Since we are paying for that the funding comes from the state
mm-hmm.
in 1%, I'm just trying to figure out whether Indian reservations, they should be responsible for mm-hmm. some payment of this gambling problem.
Well, Chairman Lynn, that's a very good question. What we do know is a lot of information from the people who come into our state funded programs. And from there, we know that about 70% of them are coming in reporting that it's a lottery product that has hooked them. So that's 70%. Now, with the tribes, one of the interesting things that has occurred over time, as you know, we had more tribes offering casinos, that number has grown from 10% of the population who are coming in saying that their place, the primary place of gambling was a casino. Now we're up to 18%. The other interesting statistic here is I wanted to assess, well, what is the impact, the relative impact of having a casino close by? And what we found are if the treatment program is located within 50 driving miles of a casino, the number of clients that come in reporting a preference for casino gambling more than doubles. So we know that having a casino close by increases the number of problem gamblers coming into treatment reporting that's their primary location to gamble. So, you know, the quick answer is 70% lottery, 18% Native American casinos.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Marla, would it be possible to get a budget breakdown of your programs? I'm curious to see how the program works in cooperation with drug and alcohol programs throughout the state as well. I'm very much supportive of the idea of using the lottery funds for programs. I would just like to see how it breaks down to see if we can get an overview of if the money is being used efficiently.
Chairman, mm-hmm. Representative Buckley, I anticipate that question might come up, so I brought our budget.
Thank you.
And at this time, I'll have it distributed to you. What you'll see from, this is the big picture budget. I didn't go into the precise allocations to which, you know, what counties are getting what. But what this will show is that outpatient treatment is receiving 67% of the funds. Our prevention / public health component is getting 15%, and then there's a lot of smaller portions. Currently, administration is very lean at only about 3.5%. I'm the only person funded under these funds in the Department of Human Services. So as you'll see, that what you're looking at here, I think, represents a system where the vast majority of the monies are going toward direct care activities, and a relatively small portion is going toward the other infrastructure type activities, which are very, very critical in order for a system to function. Yet the emphasis and priority is placed on monies going toward direct services. And, you know, I'm not familiar enough with the other budgets to tell you how this compares.
Mr. Chairman, we have one follow-up. In terms of cooperation with programs for drug and alcohol treatment, is there a system of communication with programs in the counties that are working on drug and alcohol issues, since there does seem to be, again, that statistic was interesting, 71% say that they don't have a problem, but for the other 29% of people that do have also a drug and alcohol problem, is there cooperation?
Chairman, Representative Buckley, the system... One of the facets of the system is that we fund somebody within a county, or I shouldn't say a county, within a region. Generally, that's a county, but sometimes it's a collection of smaller counties which form a region, where that person is funded, and in large part, what they are tasked to do is to integrate services systems within their perspective county or region. That's how we were able to institute some of these screening measures, so that in several counties, the drug and alcohol programs, the mental health programs, the children and family assistance programs will screen for problem gambling. It's because of that service worker who then goes out and meets with groups of individuals in other service sections, educates them about problem gambling, discusses with their managers and administrators how problem gambling could be screened or addressed given their particular target population. So we try. I don't think we're 100% there by any means in terms of getting saturation with all of our colleagues.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Dr. Marvel. Is DHS where this should be, this program?
Chairman Representative Nelson, I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the...
Is DHS where this program should be?
DHS has the administrative responsibility for the gambling treatment funds. So 1% of the lottery revenues go into this problem gambling treatment fund from there.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I understand that, but I'm just saying, should this program be a part of DHS with its huge clientele?
That's a good question. Being a DHS employee, it's a little...
Well, I'm sorry to put you in a spot, but that's the only way we can ever get these programs moved. Sorry, Mr. Chair, for not addressing.
What I can do is I can tell you some of the advantages and disadvantages of having this program housed within the Department of Human Services. The big advantage is that, as you know, the Department of Human Services also administers programs for drug and alcohol, mental health, and so we share clients with our problem gambling clients. It logically makes sense to have this program administered through the Department of Human Services in terms of integrating services to most efficiently and effectively reach those persons that need it. Now, at another level, it has been problematic. And the place it's problematic is that DHS is a huge agency with a very, very large budget. Now, this is the only the lottery revenues that go to DHS go into this program. That's the only program within DHS that receives any type of lottery revenues. So what has happened historically when Department of Human or Administrative Services or other bodies have instructed DHS to produce cuts of their general and lottery funds, say, of, you know, give me a 10 or 20% kind of reduction, is there's only one place for them to go for their lottery numbers, and that's the way they kind of do it. They don't lump it all together. And so we keep getting cuts. And I think if... And in some parts, it's not even DHS's fault. It's the way that the system is just basically set up. It's also such a small program when, you know, it doesn't receive a heck of a lot of attention, which in some ways I really don't mind that. That has been the major issue, I think, having the Department of Human Services house or have the administrative control over these funds. It's in a position where it may not be able to protect those funds as well as if they were housed in, if a different agency had administrative responsibility over them.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Mata, could you see that the rehabilitative services that are now in DHS, such as mental health, the drug, alcohol and drug abuse, and this program, would function more efficiently and effectively if they were within a separate, independent department?
Representative Nelson, it's harder for me to speak about those programs because I'm focused on problem gambling, and that's where my energies have really been directed. So I really don't feel I'm the best person to answer that question. And I want to keep my job for the time being.
I understand that. That's fortunate for us, but it keeps us from getting the solutions we need to best serve our clients in this state because of this issue here. Yeah.
Yeah. What I can just...
I believe that the Representative Nelson raised a valid question whether it should be... under the Human Services Department, or should be under the lottery or create a special department for this issue. I think that that's some subject we need to discuss in the future.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. And before you go on, can I ask one more question? Any questions for me? Okay. Concerning the prevention, 15%. Mm-hmm. And are you trying to prevent what the state tried to promote? And then I'm not sure what the prevention is. Is that you don't gamble it? But already those gambling and that we are trying to teach them not to gamble that much, or what I couldn't understand exactly what's the prevention program you are having and how you do it.
Okay. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to address that question, because it is a point of common confusion. A lot of times people look at it as anti-gambling or gambling prevention, and really that's not what the philosophy of these services are about. What we try to do is minimize harm caused or resulting from gambling. Our programs are aimed at allowing we're from the position that we're not against gambling. What we try to do is prevent and minimize harm caused by gambling. So the way that we do that with there's two kind of ways. One, the Oregon Lottery has a large effort, which I believe Carol Brenner will talk with you a little bit about, in order to provide outreach to the state and bring people into our programs. The idea there is if people start down the course of problem gambling, we need to get them in sooner. Right now they're out there for between 4.5 to 5.5 years before they're coming in for treatment. A lot of harm is being created during that time. We want to get them in soon. So we have efforts to bring them in before greater harm is caused. So that's one place. Another thing that we do is we fund these regions, which again are mainly counties, to set up programs. Now we don't tell them exactly what to do. We give them guidelines. The reason we don't tell them what to do is because every county is a little different. Their infrastructure is different. For example, some of the human services agencies at counties have very good relationship with their school districts. Others, there's just not as much activity that can occur or collaboration. So those that might have a good relationship and collaborate on projects will then, for instance, in Lynn Benton counties, what they do there is they have a life skills training program. It's a best practice program that is used within their some of their schools, where they teach their youth to cope in a way that is helpful, that is healthy, so that they would avoid coping through the use of things like alcohol, other drugs, aggression, and now they're talking about gambling. And that's just one example of how we're trying to integrate the discussion of gambling into other type of prevention activities. So we have a real hodgepodge of different activities occurring throughout the state because, again, we give it to the counties to tell us how they're going to most effectively use these really limited resources to address the minimizing harm caused by gambling. None of them talk about the message in none of these programs is gambling to just don't do it kind of thing, or in any way talks about the abolishment of gambling. Here you'll see with some of these outreach efforts, we reach a large number of Oregonians through these various programs, 2 million, but the 2 million figure talks about those who are exposed to some of the messages, mostly through media. Just kind of in conclusion, this more formal aspect. We feel that the problem gambling services offered here in Oregon, that they work. Our enrollment is growing at a very, at really an astonishing rate. And I think that's one gauge of how well a problem gambling program is doing, because we, are so challenged to get people into services. Our short-term efficacy appears very good. Again, 80% of those entering, just walking into the door of one of our treatment centers, 6 months later, 80% of those individuals are going to report either no gambling or significantly less gambling. And the prevalence of problem gambling appears in check. Now, where that's coming from is that just these two prevalence studies, one done in 97, one done in 2000, the numbers have went down during that time. Now, that's 5 years ago. 5 years ago now. We really don't know what's happened during that 5 years, if they've gone up, if they went down, if they stabilized. However, one of the interesting aspects of Oregon is that it's one of the states that offers gambling, more types of gambling, has easier access to gambling than most states, yet its problem gambling prevalence is lower than most states, which is very odd. It's an anomaly in that regard. And based on, again, this 2000 study, we like to think, in part, it's because of the efforts that that Oregon has taken to address this issue. We feel that still much more does need to be done. We need stronger consumer protection, product safety measures, and these are some of the things that DHS and the Oregon Lottery has been talking about and we're looking at. We need stable funding for problem gambling services. Again, we took a hit last cycle when we thought the funding was going to go away, and it really disrupted our infrastructure. And we need to continue to monitor the response of a changing environment. And there again, I think it's, you know, time is due for another prevalence study to see just exactly what is occurring in the landscape of Oregon in terms of the number of problem gamblers we might have out there. So that concludes slideshow. Answer any questions. And again, I'd still like to talk with you later about some of the other activities we're doing with the Oregon Lottery.
Considering your 1% treatment money, do you think this 1% is adequate enough so you can do an adequate job for treating them?
Jim Lim, if we receive the 1%, I think we would have sufficient funds to keep the current system active to the extent of being able to address our current need. Now, if we had additional funds, we could do more. We could, for instance, right now, as you saw with the prevention and outreach, 15% of the revenues of our budget are going toward that segment. If we had larger than 1%, we would be able to greatly expand those efforts. But given the current, the other thing we could do, of course, if we had more money, is we could expand our services for our more intensive clients. We could have true inpatient treatment centers. Right now we have respite centers, which is different than a true inpatient center. So there's ways to do our job better, and of course if we had extra revenue, we'd be able to do our job better. If we received the 1%, we would be able to keep the current system, which I think is a very good system and recognized as really one of the best systems in the country, if not the best. It would support the current system. If we continue to get cuts, and one of the things that has happened over the past three biennium is instead of that 1%, we got 1%, then we got 0.9%, then 0.8%, this current biennium we're at 0.7%. So we're progressively getting a smaller proportion of those monies, even though during that whole time that no less than 1% statute has been in the books. So there lies the crux of the problem. It's actually being able to access those funds.
A couple of questions. What is the current budgeting level in the current governor's budget? What is the dollar figure?
Representative Dallin, the governor based his allocation on 1%. At that time, it was it's much lower than it is currently. Now, that is because that was based on the December forecast, the December revenue forecast, and that was before any new revenues from video slots were factored into the forecast. And I'm trying to remember what his is. So it's something like, I think 7.2 or something like that.
But it is an increase.
It's a definite increase, yes.
My next follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And if I were to come away from this with anything, stability may be even more important than the dollar figure, the stability and knowing you will have stable funding is as important as how much?
Representative Dillon, that is correct. Stability is critical. It's, I think, much more critical in some regards to this system than other systems, and it's because this system's really small. So if we lose one provider, like we did in Columbia Clatsop region, those two counties, we lost one provider. He was concerned he was going to lose his job. He left that position. Well, he was the entire problem gambling program. It went from a very, very successful program where they were seeing a large number, relatively speaking, of clients down to something like 75% drop in the number of people coming in. So because it is such a small program, when there's that kind of instability, it has dramatic effects, and it's hard to recover from that as well, because we don't have a pool of people we can draw from to fill any vacancies that might emerge.
Follow up.
Yes, and then the final follow up. You would then, if the present budget figures were implemented, you would go from 5.6 to 7.2, roughly a 20% increase. Is that correct?
I believe it's at least a 20% increase. It could even be a little higher if the governor's recommended budget was used to fund the program.
Thank you.
So that the treatment amount just goes up as the gambling revenue continues to climb, then the percentage, 1% just goes up, right?
Representative Room, yes, in theory, that's what is supposed to happen. And again, it makes a lot of sense, because the more gambling revenue means the larger the gambling losses and the more problem gamblers we have out there. We think a large proportion of the money that is gambled is from problem gamblers, so there's a direct correlation between revenue from gambling to the number of problem gamblers, I believe.
So somewhat I'm afraid if we give you more money, then state revenue might fall.
Chairman Lim, in some ways that would be nice if that was the case. However, I don't believe that we have that much effect. And again, because what we're trying to do is avoid harm caused by gambling. Conceptually, if we really were successful at this program, revenue should not be impacted a whole lot. What should happen is we would have more people that gamble at a recreational level, at a safe level of play. We believe we'd have more people because we would be able to reduce the risk of problem gambling, therefore making the activity more attractive to a larger number of people. If somebody thought an activity was safe, more people would engage in that activity. So at a theoretical level, and there are some models out there that show that even with an incredibly effective effort to minimize harm caused by gambling, we could still generate a lot of revenue, and those revenue would be coming from a source that just makes a lot more sense to come from. But you know, we're not sure exactly how our programs would affect the bottom line. But again, I don't think it would be that dramatic.
Earlier presentation, some time ago, we were told about 5% of the adult population the problem gamblers, but you are giving us a 3%. And I'm not sure who is giving us that clear definition and what is the problem gamblers.
Mm-hmm.
The process.
Yeah, Representative Lim, the figures that again, it has to do with what study we're referencing and what jurisdiction. If we're talking about Oregon, there's been only those two prevalent studies, and the latest one shows that 2.3%. It's not really clear if that holds today, I mean, since 2000 and that study, there has been a large change, I think, in the Oregon culture. There is greater gambling availability. There's greater acceptance. That number may not apply anymore. The 5% number that you heard most likely came from some national type studies. There was a large study, I believe, in 1999, the National Commission, and I think that found about 5% in general. There was some problem gambling.
Right. The Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke about the difference between states raising money through the problem gambler and through entertainment factor, if you will, of folks who gamble at lower levels. Are there some different things that states have done to create more of a line between gambling as entertainment and gambling as a problem gambling? An example of the sort of thing I'm thinking about is, I understand, on a 5%, a 5 cent slot machine, if you will, this wouldn't be Oregon, but elsewhere, you could actually wager a huge amount per minute because of the ability to double the bet or other such factors. Are there states that have limited or placed limits in the way machines operate or other things that basically reduce kind of the damage you can do yourself per hour and make it more entertainment and less likely to destroy yourself financially?
Representative Merkley, you're bringing up a facet of the field that is it's coming into focus. And that is, how does the actual machine, the structure of the machine, the design of the machine, influence a person's gambling and influence the amount of revenue that might be generated from problem gamblers versus social gamblers? It's a very new field. There's been some attempts out there trying these different features to help minimize the harm that the game may produce. Not a lot has been done. We do know that there's several features of machines that promote excessive play. Now, excessive play could lead to problem gambling. It's some of those things you talked about. The low initial bet size. It's a lot easier for somebody to approach a machine and put in a nickel than it would be if that was a $5 machine. The opportunity to raise one's bet level, so to go from a nickel up to a $5 machine, so having that kind of progressive ability is another thing. There's actually a whole host of things that can be done. Now, knowing what features promote excessive play, some people, and also knowing the characteristics of a problem gambler, have tried to build features into the machines. Other jurisdictions have done this to minimize the addictive potential of them. Some of those things were like putting clocks on the display, because people report being lost. You know, they lose sense of time and space when they're engaged in these games. If they have a clock, then that idea is it helps them stay in tune with reality. One jurisdiction has done that. The Oregon Lottery, I think, is considering that feature. Another one is, instead of displaying the money in terms of credits, which takes them a little further away from reality, it's displaying money in terms of money, in terms of the monetary value that one has in the bank. So it's, instead of 100 credits, you have, you know, $25 or whatever that is. There's not a real strong science behind saying this feature and that feature will work and what will the outcome be of this feature or that feature. It's just too new. However, I think conceptually it makes sense that, you know, some of these features are probably going to have some of the desired impact. And it makes sense to me, you know, to at least experiment with some of those to see if we can reduce gambling by making the games kind of less potent in terms of people developing problems related to them. sorry if that wasn't a, but unfortunately the field just isn't a place where I can give a real crystallized response.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Merkley's question, who in our system is responsible for doing that investigation into what leads to excessive gambling with our machines or not? Is that responsibility fall on you to advise the lottery, or is there anyone with that responsibility currently?
Representative Buckley, it's interesting. Again, this is so new that it's really, the focus has been on revenue, maximizing revenues.
Right.
And currently what I could tell you is that the Oregon Lottery doesn't have a problem gambling expert on their staff. And fortunately we have a very good relationship with Carol Bono, and the Oregon Lottery Commission has been expressed a great deal of concern around this issue and has supported problem gambling services wholeheartedly. And so I think it's a very strong and cooperative relationship that we have now. So at this point, I function as probably the primary consultant on these matters. It's just kind of evolved because there was that need, and when you say the responsibility itself, I've put myself in a position where I try to be as responsible regarding this as possible, and offer as much information as I have available to me. Officially, I really have no jurisdiction over. Some of those decisions that are made.
One quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, what would be the process? Where would you need to get direction from in order to take on the responsibility or to define the responsibility for the investigation into excessive gambling with our lottery games? Would that have to come from Superior DHS? Would it have to come from a...
Representative Buckley, the DHS is very supportive of me working cooperatively with the lottery. There's no obstacles there at all. We do have a system where I provide consultation to the lottery. Now, some of it is, well, it's just that I'm an advisor, if you may. And there's certainly been occasion where I've been asked to advise on such matters. Now, in terms of the decision-making process, we have Carol Bone in the room. I should bring Carol up here and have her talk to you a little bit more about the... we're talking about lottery business now, and that is, the business that the lottery, the way that lottery conducts its business is something that, again, I only serve as an advisory function.
I'll wait and talk to Carol then. Thank you.
Could you come, please? Carol Bono, Assistant Director for Marketing. Welcome. Glad to see you again here.
Thank you. Good to see you. Good morning, Chair Lynn, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Carol Bono, Assistant Director for Marketing for the Oregon Lottery. I do just want to reiterate that I've been involved in the outreach and education about problem gambling in the Oregon market since the early 90s when we did introduce video lottery into the marketplace. And I have to say, since Jeff Murata's arrival in Oregon to take on the role of the problem gambling treatment and outreach, those efforts have been much more well organized. He has been a consultant for us over all of that time. And Jeff is a real asset to Oregon, not to mention the Oregon Lottery specifically, as we develop our programs to educate Oregonians. And as always, you know that our mandate at the Oregon Lottery is to maximize revenue, commensurate with the public good, and we take the commensurate with the public good very part of our mission very seriously. And certainly the problem gambling outreach is a key element of that. just for an example of how we work together, and we were going to show you a new campaign that we are just launching, but I'll give you a little bit of background of how we got to that campaign. Is last fall, DHS had mentioned that the number of women seeking treatment in Oregon was actually on a decline rather than an increase, which seemed contradictory to the information we had, that there actually seemed to be more potential women problem gamblers in Oregon. So when we heard that message, we went back and looked at our education programs, which were really primarily directed using male actors in our television and our print materials. We said maybe that's really having an influence on that we're not actually talking about audience. So I attended a national conference on problem gambling, and that conference was focused towards women who were in recovery, and I listened very carefully to their messages about you needed to talk to women differently. So when we came back from there, we developed a campaign that was trying to speak differently to this group of people who Jeff already talked about, the fact that some of the things that they do is they take time away from their family. They're less dependable at work, and that instills a feeling of operating outside of their core values. So we developed a television campaign where we feature a series of five women who verbally are talking about how they felt when they were gambling, that they felt guilty, that they'd abandoned some of their responsibilities, they felt alone and isolated. While the visual, in contrast, shows five different women going about normal activities, and they're showing them in recovery. So the idea was to let people know that you can get help. There is a place that you can reach out to get help and get back to a normal lifestyle. And at the end, the message is call 1-866-2-STOP-NOW. Treatment's free, confidential, and it works. That's been the campaign that we've had out there for some time, which I know some of you had an opportunity to see those when you visited the lottery. That campaign is launching March 7th, which is the beginning of Problem Gambling Awareness Week nationally, and we're releasing it at that time. Really as an outreach effort to say, let's put some focused attention towards women. So this is an example of where Jeff counsels us and says, here's a need, what can we do to help that need? Another place where he is helping us right now is as we look at the introduction of line games is to address some of the issues that have come up here is, where is the prevention part of this? How can the lottery help on the side where you try to teach people about gaming, about playing responsibly before someone can develop a problem? We are looking at features in our VLTs that put clocks on the terminals, that they change credits from dollars, from credits to dollars and cents. We're looking at another facet of our campaign that will teach people about odds, payouts, what is a line game, how does it play differently, and what kind of things can people do to minimize their risk, which is set a time limit, set a budget, don't borrow money. And all of these things will become a more visible part of our outreach campaign. I also did want to mention that, as I mentioned last time, I'm a member of the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, which is a nonprofit group that conducts research and provides information to the treatment community. And they have asked us, as well as Spirit Mountain, to help fund a third prevalence study prior to the introduction of line games, so we really can see whether the trend that we have seen going down is still going down. Has it gone up? What are we dealing with in the marketplace right now? I wanted to show this to you. I know I did show it at the lottery office, but this is another example where Jeff came to us and asked us to help in the creation of some outreach materials to audiences at risk. And these audiences are varied. It's workforce people are at risk. Gambling on the job, don't lose all you've worked so hard for, call 866-2-STOP-NOW. 877, sorry. This is aimed at college students. Gambling too much, sports books, poker, internet, call and get back in control. This is one talking to elderly audiences. Can't wait to gamble, ask yourself why. This is, again, an audience at risk that has a lot of free time perhaps on their hands and maybe spends more than they can afford. Talking to teens before they get into a position where they're entering into the gambling world, they do play games.
And they need to understand that when you risk anything, that's gambling. Gambling is a risky business. Know the odds. This, again, is aimed at education. There's a series of brochures that we produced and a large poster that says, who do you think has a gambling problem? Really, the message is anybody can, and there's a resource for them. And these are materials that the treatment and prevention people across the state are taking out as we head into Problem Gambling Awareness Week. And this fits within the guidelines of our program, because as we spend our money doing outreach, we measure the number of people seeking treatment. We have a target to increase that number 10% every year. And the idea is that even though we do reach a number of people, there are a lot more people we could reach, and that's really the lottery's goal that's set by our commission, is to increase the number of people seeking treatment. So that's kind of just a broad overview of where we are and how we work with Jeff, but we really do see him as a consultant to us. I guess the other thing I was going to mention is we use our vendors in the gaming industry as a resource, and even though we don't technically have an expert at the Oregon Lottery, I make sure those materials funnel through me. We have some public affairs people that read through those materials. There's a lot of work being done in Canada on the prevention side. We try to pattern ourselves after some of the very successful programs up there.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Dellum?
If I may, Mr. Chair, two. One is, are your efforts part of the 0.7%, or are they on top of that?
Chair Lim, Representative Dellum, our efforts are part of our administrative budget at the Oregon Lottery. They do not come out of the 1%.
Then the second question, is there, because this is, we've just been told, a new program or a new process, when there are program standards for determining what is effective, are there program standards that determine what's effective?
Chairman Lim, Representative Dellum, we use the Problem Gambling Helpline as our measure of success. And what they do is they provide a report to us monthly to say how many people are seeking treatment. And they map that against the time when the Oregon Lottery's media is on the air. When we're on the air, typically we have television and newspaper that run at the same time. And what we can see is when our media is on the air, there is a spike in the calls to treatment. And when it goes off, there's a gradual decline, and you'll see another spike. So that is our best measure, is that if you're actually seeing people pick up the phone when they hear our messages, that is people that are at least seeking the treatment. We don't measure the number of people who actually go into treatment. Those are measures that are tracked by DHS.
And are there any institutions that can provide a performance audit on the success of your programs, other than watching use of the program spike?
Chairman Lim, Representative Dellum, are you speaking specifically about the Oregon Lottery's efforts?
Yes. Normally, we have a natural tension between the auditor and the provider or the service organization. And what I'm looking, is there an organization outside that could audit performance on our prevention program? And do they do that?
Chairman Lim, Representative Dellum, at this time we don't have an outside audit firm that measures the success of our program. Again, those are what we try to do is listen to the need, put messages out there, and try to measure through the things that DHS captures. It's certainly something that we could investigate. It's just not something I've ever heard done actually in the lottery industry.
Thank you very much.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you. Just one quick question. Can you remind me what other states or the Canadian model, who has line games and how far along are they? Are they 6 months ahead of us, a year ahead of us, 2 years ahead of us?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley. Canadian lotteries are the ones that have the most prevalence of having line games over a long period of time. There are several U.S. states who have line games, but they all work so differently, it's very difficult for us to compare ourselves to them. So we typically look at the Canadian lotteries as a guideline. Most of them have had line games since the early 90s. And their programs and how they differ from typically what's done in the United States is they teach moderation, and they teach people the guidelines that I was talking about. But they have had line games for well over 10 years, and so they're a bit ahead of us in that curve. I did want to clarify, we have had a problem gambling education program in Oregon since the early 90s. I think maybe it's 1995. So this isn't a new program for us. It's just a new element that we're talking to women and a new element that we are looking at a prevention side rather than simply the treatment side, which is when someone has a problem, you get them when they've already recognized a problem and get into treatment. We're really trying to back it up and say, let's educate people before they have a problem. I'm not sure that answered your question.
I'm pleased that you are following what the Canadian experience has been and using your best practices off of that. Thank you.
Okay. I have a nagging question concerning the constitutionality that the, anyone looked at the issue, the line game is a casino or not. I mean, we need to clear that issue that our constitution clearly states that we cannot have a casino in our state. But at the same time, we are going into a territory that the line game could be considered as a casino. And without having the AG's opinion on it, that going into that area, I think this is something I feel uncomfortable. Is it possible? Can you relay my message to the director and commissioner, find out the where line game stands in our constitution?
Chairman Lim, I'll make sure to take that question back and have the director respond to you. I can't answer that myself right
now. I understand that. If you delay that message,
sure.
And we need to find out this answer before we do have a line game. Maybe if not, we might have a greater problem in the future. Okay, so thank you very much. If there's no question, I have one person, Steve Gilbert. And
thank you.
Welcome, Steve. Would you identify your name and also who you are with?
Yes, good morning. I talked to you a couple weeks ago. I'm Steve Gilbert. I am a lottery retailer and a lifelong resident of the state of Oregon. First off, I'd like to thank you for letting me address you again.
Thank you.
Oregon's an interesting place. Instead of taxing the gambling industry, the state has chosen to run the game. In talking about addiction and gambling problems, I'd like to talk about the state. Remember when the state had to pay for its programs the old-fashioned way? Make no mistake, the state is addicted to the gambling money. Our governor has directed the lottery to add slot games. Ostensibly, it's to support our state police. Stand for Children, the Oregon PTA, Oregon School Employees Association, and others are lobbying for a greater share of this gambling bonanza. Adding slots is easy money. All you have to do is turn them on. They've had them sitting in the computer in Salem for quite a while. You turn them on and the money starts rolling in. The numbing numbers are this. Dr. Murata just showed that 1,500 people sought treatment in the state in 2003. He predicts that by adding the slot games, we will see 8,000 people join their ranks this year. Adding to, again, his numbers, 1,000 divorces caused by gambling problems. Untold bankruptcies, foreclosures, and suicides. Additional social costs, or actually, excuse me, additional costs to our social programs. Again, his estimate, $47 million, give or take. Again, those are dollars that are going to cost children's services, all those financial aspects. It does not take into account pain or suffering. Are we to believe that this is simply the cost of doing business? I propose that the state should send a letter of appreciation to each of those that selflessly contribute to the success of the slot tax program by placing the state's need in front of their own families. And perhaps that Stand for Children, the PTA, the Oregon School Employees Association could sign those letters as well, again showing their appreciation. After July, when we see a trooper on the road, we can remember that it was the easy money from the slots that put him or her there to protect us. That was basically the gist of what I had to say. One thing I thought was interesting in Dr. Murata's comment was convenience gambling that he said earlier in his presentation. And that is, you know, why to your answer, or to your question, Chairman, was, you know, why do we spend more money in the state? It's convenience gambling and perhaps convenience store gambling. I have, again, two locations and have recommended several people to go to call the hotline. One person comes to mind. He is a woman that is, I suppose, about 50 now. She showed up at our door 3 years ago and came in and spent a lot of money on Keno. And she showed up in a nice Mercedes. And we looked at her and thought, well, dang, you know. And she spent, again, quite a bit of money. For her short time with us, my one location shot up to the top five in the state. Okay? Thanks to her. It concerned us. Obviously, I mean, she's driving a Mercedes. You would think that, well, maybe that's just her discretionary income. I did some research, found out that her husband was an attorney. I talked to our lottery rep and said, yeah, you know, she's great. You want to make her happy, all right? She is the top Keno player in the state of Oregon. And when I did have a chance to talk to her, she told me that she was the top one, or probably, I don't know, 2002 or 3, I don't know. So, you know, what's a lot of money to me is not a lot of money to some other people. We let her play. The next couple of weeks, she decided, well, hey, you know, I don't have the money today. Can I write a check? That was a decision that we had to make as an operator. You know, if it's a check, we're going to be financially responsible if that does not clear. You know, finding out what we knew, we went ahead and we accepted that check. About four checks later or five checks later, it didn't clear. So, you know, we talked to her when she came in, and we talked to her about treatment. Her response was to laugh and say, yeah, they tell me I need treatment. My husband's told me, everybody's told me, so what? I don't need treatment. Well, I don't know where she is today. The best of my knowledge, she is still out there gambling, but we've chosen not to, you know, take her business. you know, it's really easy to look at these numbers and statistics, and what's more important is to look at the real effect, the individual personal costs that this state is willing to gamble on its citizens.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Buckley.
Mr. Gilbert, thank you very much. I share your view that we don't do things the old-fashioned way anymore. I'd be personally willing to pay more taxes myself to fund my kids' schools. Do you have any suggestions, any proposed solutions of how we can turn the attitude of our fellow citizens around to actually pay for the programs we need?
No, what I do have is an interesting comment, though. If it's one of you in here, I'm sorry. I read about 2 weeks ago that it was proposed that, you know, we need to lower our capital gains tax in the state of Oregon. We need to cut it in half. And I don't know if that's really happening. I'm sorry, I haven't paid close attention. And my response to that was, you know, you've got a capital gains tax, we want to cut it in half. How many divorces has capital gains tax cost? How many suicides? How many people need treatment? How many bankruptcies and foreclosures? So I guess that's the best answer that I can give you. I don't think it's cutting any specific other taxes out there. And maybe it's not creating other taxes. You know, what is it? The state minimum tax for a corporation is $10. The contribution of corporations in this state is across the country has declined. I think that's probably not a bad place to start.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right.
For the second time to testify in my
Thank
committee.
You.
Okay. Is there any other person like to testify on this issue? If not, then our meeting is adjourned on Wednesday.